Org online, which usually airs on Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. Stay tuned for Off the Hook. That is coming up, and it's now 7 p.m. Stay tuned.
Hello, it's WBAI New York. It's Wednesday evening. It's 7 o'clock. It's Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. A Billy Bump for the best, expect the worst.
Very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein over here. Kyle over there.
Yo, what's up?
We have over in Skype land, Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Alex. I can't hear you, Alex.
Good evening.
Okay, you're going to have to improve your microphone. And we have Gila.
Good evening.
Didn't expect to be third, did you? Yeah, Alex, your microphone, something really messed up with it.
Is that right?
Okay.
Is it still difficult?
Much better now. Much better.
What about that?
That's terrible now. I think you have to lean forward.
All right.
Like it's the 1990s or something.
Yeah, there's a proximity effect here.
Yeah, I don't know what kind of hardware you're using there, but it's...
You are coming in, though. We see you. And
that doesn't help the radio audience, does it?
Yeah, okay. Looks like he's got some hardware he's still tidying up there.
Did you guys...
It's a tin can and some string. He's getting soup out of a can.
I just was alerted to this tweet. Do you guys look at Twitter at all? Somebody tweeted that they're not going to listen to Off the Hook anymore because we're too anti-Putin. And I mean, thank you for that. That was the humor that I needed today. But, oh, my goodness, we're too anti-Putin. Can you be too anti-Putin? I don't know. Apparently around here you can.
Well, this is as good a time as ever to test my new hardware. Is this any better?
I hope you got the receipt.
Seriously? It's that bad?
Well, it's a little distorted, but then again...
I think you went too far the other way.
Alex, you get kind of distorted sometimes.
Might be too close. You know, just back it up a little, and then you're just right. It's like...
Other radio shows test things out before they go on the air?
No, let him try it. Let him try it. He's got it. I think he's got it now.
Well, testing. How are we doing here?
That's fine.
We're hackers. We test hardware out on the air. So, how do you feel about that?
Okay, we're fine. All right, we got all the lightheartedness out of the way, some lightheadedness as well. Onto the serious subject matter, and we had the day in court yesterday for our friend Virgil Griffith, who it's been a long time coming. You know, we expected this back in September when he was convinced to plead guilty and sentencing was pushed back to, I think, December, then to January, and then all the way to April at his lawyer's behest. We'll get into that later. And it wasn't good. We didn't expect it to be good, but it really wasn't good. He was sentenced to around 5 years in federal prison and forced to pay a $100,000 fine. I'd like to I'd like to just read a couple of excerpts from a couple of different stories. First, this story from Coindesk.com. I'm going to read the opening paragraph to this story, and I'm going to read an opening paragraph to a different story. Former Ethereum developer Virgil Griffith will serve 63 months in prison and pay a $100,000 fine for helping North Koreans use cryptocurrencies to evade sanctions. Yeah, that's how the story is being reported in most of the mass media. I even saw that on BBC. And it's wrong, because that's not what he did. He did not help North Korea use cryptocurrencies to evade sanctions. Now, I'd like to read you the opening paragraph to a story from The Daily Beast, written by our friend Jose Pagliari. Virgil Griffith, a computer programmer known for his contributions to Wikipedia and the digital currency Ethereum, was sentenced to 63 months in prison on Tuesday for speaking at a cryptocurrency conference in North Korea. Boom. That's it. That's the story. It's amazing what you can convey in an opening paragraph. And I think, you know, most people who, and I got to say, most people have no sympathy for Virgil because of the way it's been presented, because they believe that is what he was doing, that he was helping North Korea. When in fact, he went to North Korea, spoke at a conference, answered some questions, which is what you do when people ask you questions in North Korea, and then got involved and to his own admission, a bit over involved in trying to figure out how to crack the security that would allow North Korea to evade sanctions. It was a mental exercise. There's no reason on earth he would be interested in helping the North Korean regime. It was a challenge. And that's something that so many people, unfortunately, in the legal system don't seem to understand. Alex, you're a rare exception. I'm going to read a little bit more from this story until I physically can't take it anymore. The CoinDesk story, that is. And most of it's not badly written, but the facts just are really upsetting. Though the crime carried a maximum penalty of 20 years, Griffith's plea deal with federal prosecutors brought the sentence down to a range of 63 to 78 months. So I guess we're supposed to feel grateful for that. Yeah. He spent approximately 2 years in custody, though he was released on bail for 14 of those months, and the court will count the remaining 10 months as time served. So even though his life has been living hell since 2019, those 3 years or so, 10 months, that's what he gets. The sentence was handed down by U.S. District Judge Kevin Castell of the Southern District of New York. And as mentioned, it's on the lower end of the prosecution's suggested sentencing guidelines. So let's all bow down and give thanks for that. Before he was sentenced, Virgil and his attorneys had a chance to address the court with any last objections or remarks. Brian Klein, who was Griffith's lead attorney, urged Judge Castell to consider factors that he believed had not been accounted for in the prosecution's sentencing guidelines, including the harsh conditions at Brooklyn's Metropolitan Detention Center, where he has been held, where I believe he's being held right now. Klein described, and listeners, prepare yourself, described several really trying and inhumane conditions that Virgil experienced at MDC, including extended solitary quarantines due to COVID-19 outbreaks, no family visits, limited access to blankets and warm clothing, even being forced to use his sink as a toilet. He said that Virgil has been limited to two or less meals a day, usually peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, because gangs in MDC control the kitchens and the commissary. And because of those harsh conditions, Klein asked the judge to consider counting the 10 months that he has spent in prison as double, and also asked that his client be moved to Allenwood in Pennsylvania, where he might be closer to extended family. I don't know how the second request went, but the first request denied. Klein also informed Judge Castell of recent psychological assessment of Griffith, et cetera, et cetera. He was found by a psychiatrist to be treatable, not likely to reoffend. Didn't matter. When Virgil himself was given an opportunity to speak, he told the court that he had spent time in prison thinking about how he genuinely, arrogantly, and erroneously thought I knew better than his loved ones who warned him against going to North Korea. I've learned my lesson. I'm still profoundly embarrassed that I am here and of what I have done. Why is that not enough? The hell he's gone through already. And basically owning up to what he did, what he actually did. Why doesn't that seem to matter at all? I want to read some things the judge said, because I think this is really, really important and revealing. This is what Judge Castell said. There is an argument that Virgil Griffith is a kind and thoughtful man. He goes on to say, but those are not the facts. How dare he? This is my friend. This is somebody I know well. Did you even have a conversation with this guy? And you preach from your bench and condemn him to 5 years in prison based on ignorance, based on hatred and ignorance, because you do not know him. You didn't bother to find out. You might as well just be reading Fox News. What you see here, Castell continued, is an intentionality and a desire to educate people on how to evade sanctions. Note the words there. Educate people. Not just educate North Korea. People. All of us. You, Judge Castell, could have heard something. You could have learned something from this. The FBI could have learned something. We all could have benefited from this knowledge. But no, he had this desire to educate people on something that you don't want people to know about. The security holes he's talking about, still there. You're not going to learn about them now. And you can't blame him for things that happen when he's not around to point out the security holes in the first place. Judge Castell read a series of text messages and emails from Virgil, which he admits to sharing information with North Korea for the express purpose of helping the repressive Kim regime evade sanctions. Well, I'd like to see those very messages and interpret them the way they were intended. Because text messages are not broadcast to the world. They're sent to individuals, and they can contain sarcasm. They can contain exaggeration. They can be completely fictionalized. But I don't expect the federal judge to understand that. We're just looking at the literal interpretation. And when you do that, you can condemn somebody for almost anything. But this is what really apparently upset Judge Castell more than anything. A photo of Virgil at the conference wearing a traditional North Korean suit. Hey, I got news for you, Judge. Can I call him Judge? Is that too disrespectful? Your Honor. Your Honor. And I'm air quoting. That's what you get when you go to North Korea. You get a suit, and that's what you have to wear. Okay? It's not a choice. It's not Virgil being a wise guy. Although he could be a wise guy, and there's nothing wrong with that. But he was wearing what he was told to wear over there because that is the respectful way of presenting yourself in those situations. I did the same thing when I went over there. So anyway, that pissed him off, wearing a traditional North Korean suit and standing in front of a blackboard on which it read, "No sanctions," with a smiley face. Hey, you know, obviously humor is not something I'm going to be able to successfully explain here. But it's clear that this was something that was spur of the moment. I don't know if he wrote it. I hadn't heard about this before. But writing "no sanctions" with a smiley face doesn't seem like a federal crime to me. It seems just like a bit of whimsy and mischief. Is it right? It's a stupid question. Is it right to write a smiley face and say "no sanctions"? It's silly. That's the most that it possibly can be defined as. Castell goes on to say, the fact of the matter is Virgil Griffith hoped to come home to Singapore, which is where he lived, by the way, or elsewhere as a crypto hero. Apparently the worst thing could possibly be. To be admired and praised for standing up to government sanctions, for his fearlessness and nobility. He blasted Virgil's history of cooperation with the government. He's blasting Virgil's history of cooperation with our government.
Look how fast they sell you out.
What the hell? both before and after his trip to Pyongyang. which the defense rightfully held up as evidence of his good nature. But Judge Castell called it narcissism. This guy is willing to play both sides of the street as long as he is a center of attention, Castell said. To a room of people that were hanging on to his every word. You're a damn federal judge. You're the center of attention. You know what it feels like. It's not a crime to want attention. Okay, he's guilty of that. He was on a reality show, and I know that, you know, boosted his ego a bit once. And, you know, he figures things out, and when he does, he gets praised, and he likes the praise. That's not a crime. And to imply that it is, simply because he was proud of what he was able to figure out and he was willing to share it with the FBI, with the U.S. government. But this judge considers that a bad thing. No, you just want to be the center of attention. Obviously, you want Kim Jong-un to be the winner in all this. What is this based on? It's fantasy. It's fiction. Both the judge and the prosecution, get this, reference the ongoing war in Ukraine, as well as the U.S. government's use of sanctions against Russia to justify the need for a harsh sentence to prevent future violations of U.S. sanctions. How dare you imply that Virgil would ever, ever take the side of Russia against Ukraine and basically help people get slaughtered? And help in the invasion of powerless countries next to superpowers? No, that is not who he is. But implying that with these words, it is so damn offensive. I'd like to now go over to the other story that is a little bit more fair from the Daily Beast. At a federal court in New York City, U.S. District Judge P. Kevin Castell handed down the stiff 5-year sentence. Yeah, it's a stiff sentence. It's not a minimal sentence. It's a stiff sentence, as well as a $100,000 fine, marking an end to an FBI investigation that at times seemed like a heavy-handed crackdown. Thank you. You won't get that from the mass media. To North Korea watchers aware of the lengths that Kim Jong-un's henchmen will go to learn about cryptocurrency and blockchain in order to skirt sanctions and boost the country's nuclear weapons program, the spread of knowledge on cryptocurrency seems dangerous. Yeah, spread of knowledge is always dangerous. This is something we know. We've been spreading knowledge for a good long time. And people are always trying to stop us from doing it. Because knowledge is power. And that can be dangerous. North Korea's obsession and dependency on cryptocurrency has no bounds. And they'll be quick to take advantage of a misjudgment made by otherwise smart and capable individuals. That's what Vikram Thakur, technical director at Symantec, told the Daily Beast. Under the bite of harsh international sanctions, North Korea has been hacking cryptocurrency-related entities for years to generate revenue for the regime. From 2019 to 2020 alone, this is before Virgil could have even helped. Kim's hackers stole $316.4 million worth of virtual assets to fund North Korea's weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile programs, according to a United Nations investigation. And, you know, maybe they used the money for something else, too. I don't know if it's necessarily just used for the evil things. But the point is, the sanctions are there for a reason. We all know that. Kimberly Jane Ravener, federal prosecutor with the Southern District of New York, said Virgil's actions, quote, struck at the heart of the United States sanctions regime, unquote, and pointed out several text messages where Virgil made clear his intention was to teach North Korea how to dodge restrictions. Again, show me the text messages, because I bet they don't say that. According to his lawyers, after his North Korean speaking engagement, Virgil actually went straight to the U.S. Embassy in Singapore, where he was residing at the time, to tell them all about the experience. He also chose to meet with the FBI without a lawyer in New York. I was there. Well, I wasn't at the FBI meeting. I was there in New York urging him to get a lawyer before he went there. And that was a big mistake. Trusting the FBI was a huge mistake. And anyone out there who ever gets a call from the FBI saying, we just want to talk to you, do not trust them. This is proof right now that you cannot trust them. They will tell you, oh, yeah, that nothing's no problem at all, and thank you for being honest with us, and please tell us more. And then a few months later, they'll arrest you at an airport when you're trying to visit your family on Thanksgiving. They'll make things up. Go with a lawyer, or don't go at all. The arrest immediately generated criticism as the exceedingly eccentric and devoted community of cryptocurrency enthusiasts cast their prosecution as a crackdown on free speech. We are exceedingly eccentric, I guess. Meanwhile, the federal government played right into that by shrouding the case in secrecy. So many court files were kept sealed that journalist Matthew Russell Lee, who runs the publication Inner City Press, asked the judge to reconsider in a letter that noted the sealings and withholding here are unacceptable and go beyond those requested even in the Central Intelligence Agency trial of accused WikiLeaks leaker Joshua Schultz. During his chats with FBI agents, Virgil came clean and offered to help the feds explore his North Korean contacts and activities, according to a source close to Virgil. This source described at length his willingness to cooperate with the American intelligence agencies and the potential to become something of a spy asset. Those hopes were dashed, obviously, when they pounced on him. His defense team also noted that in similar cases where people visited sanctioned countries to speak at business and academic conferences, Americans typically got off with a cautionary letter from the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control. But federal prosecutors countered that Virgil did more than appear as a guest for a single event, citing his months-long conversations with co-conspirators, where he detailed his willingness to help the brutal North Korean regime. Well, who are these co-conspirators? Am I one? Because I've talked to him. And, you know, theoretically, you know, you say, well, I wonder if this would work if this particular chain of events was followed. Is a system that insecure? That's absolutely how conversations go. It doesn't make people co-conspirators. It makes people co-thinkers. In one text message, Virgil explained the value of setting up a computer node in North Korea that would allow the country to take part in the computer network that processes transactions of the digital currency Ethereum. It'll make it possible to avoid sanctions on money transfers, he wrote in another text. Boy, that sounds like something you might want to look at. That's how these flaws are found. It could cause all kinds of problems. But no, we don't want to read it that way. We want to read it as some James Bond villain who just wants to cause harm to his country, which he doesn't even live in. Boy, what a hateful, horrible person he must be. And Judge Castell continued on his rant against Virgil, saying, you have to look at the text messages, which I want to do. Release them. I'd like to see them. He has to do a lot of work on himself. Yeah. All right. Well, you know, that's the situation. Alex, I assume I'm allowed to criticize a federal judge on the air, but I don't know anymore. You know, for the last few years, we've all been kept on a short leash. You know, we didn't want to do anything that could hurt Virgil. I've not talked to Virgil in all this time. And, you know, we've been advised by his legal team to not say or do anything to avoid pissing off the judge. I hope it's time where we can finally speak honestly, because that's what I've been doing the last few minutes. And I'm fed up with being told that, you know, we have to be careful and it could get much worse. It's worse. It can't really get much worse than this. He should be out. He should be in academia. He should be teaching people. He should be living his life. This is tantamount to torture, barbaric conditions, and I'm just ashamed to be in any way a part of a system like that.
Well, let me chime in here and respond to, you know, quite a few of the things that you said, and let me first say that I agree with that last statement. I think Virgil, even though he pleaded to this crime, has been sufficiently punished, sufficiently deterred, and I think that what has happened to him has sufficiently deterred any others from engaging even in activity that barely resembles what Virgil did. You know, this is a very clear warning shot to researchers, to scientists, to academics all around the world. about being extremely careful with the people with whom the people with whom you collaborate. I do want to say, with respect to the criticism of federal judge, now I'm a member of the bar. I'm a member of the bar of the Southern District of New York, and also was working on behalf of Virgil with some of the defense team since last summer. I was not counsel of record, neither was my firm, but we had been working in the background, and so for that reason, I want to say quite clearly that I don't join in your criticism of Judge Castell or the federal judiciary. These are people in front of whom we have to continually stand up. So I'm sure that you will understand when I separate myself from your personal opinions of the judge.
Of course.
That being said,
you don't have to praise him either.
I'm not going to praise him either. I've had quite a few matters in front of Judge Castell, and he's certainly a tough but extraordinarily smart judge as well. I will say this, though. With regard to the sentence of 63 months, the plea agreement established, I believe it was 63 to 78 months was the range, and the government here was really, really going for the jugular. They wanted a higher sentence than they got yesterday. And I was in the courtroom. I took the train up, actually, from D.C. yesterday morning, and despite some Amtrak snafus that we can discuss perhaps on overtime later tonight, Amtrak snafus and then the what would look like a terrorist attack in Brooklyn, I did miss about the first 10 minutes of the hearing and then popped in and was there. But it was very, very clear that the government was going for a higher sentence. That was clear from their submission with respect to sentencing, their sentencing memorandum. They were going for 78 months or higher, and they were going for a fine of not $100,000, $1 million. They wanted a fine at the top of the spectrum here. And so, you know, as Judge Castell was reading out his reasoning and identifying the materials that he relied on in meeting out the sentence to Virgil, it was pretty harsh. And we were all expecting possibly an upwards departure, something that might have been higher than 78 months. And when he read out 63 months, I have to say, given the harsh treatment that Virgil had received in the minutes prior to that, it was a bit of a relief. But on the other hand, the defense team, that was counsel of record, and everybody that was there, myself included, were very disappointed that there wasn't a downward departure. If you read the memorandum submitted on behalf of Virgil, we were asking for, I think it was 28 months or 24 months, something like that, whatever was in the memorandum. So the judge stuck very clearly to the parameters of 63 to 78 months. There is a reason for that as well, because I believe the agreement had some kind of term about, you know, there not being really a right to an appeal if the sentence was within those parameters. If it went higher than that, I believe Virgil may have had some right to appeal the sentence component. But here it doesn't look like it. But a couple of things have factored into this that Judge Castell had identified during his monologue about Virgil before he meted out the sentence were the bail revocation that happened last summer. That did not factor into the equation very well for Virgil at all, as well as the fact that he pleaded guilty to the crime right on the eve of trial. You know, you get some points credits under the federal sentencing guidelines. I think you lose 2 points for pleading to the crime, but I don't think the judge appreciated it, and the prosecution brought it up that he had done this on the eve of trial, essentially after litigating the case. I think that with respect to the cooperation issue there, that was really disheartening for me to hear Virgil's cooperation and the fact that he self-reported to the embassy being used against him. And it goes to show you that, you know, the prosecution here was very adept. They're very smart lawyers. They're very good. They're able to take that information and use it in the context together with text messages and other activities of Virgil to make it look like it wasn't innocent, that it wasn't something for which he should be given some credit. And they did that effectively. However, you know, in most cases where people go to other countries, as you noted, Emmanuel, and as the defense brought up during their argument, most people that go to other countries and speak to, let's say, you know, Iran or others, and especially in an academic setting, and they come back and self-report and say, oh, my goodness, I shouldn't have done that. They usually get a cautionary letter. That was brought up. This was and Virgil did, in fact, self-report. He didn't hide this either. I mean, the fact that the visa wasn't in his passport, I think, was also brought up.
They don't put it in your passport. I've been there. They don't put it in your passport.
Yeah, number one, they don't put it in your passport. But number two, he wasn't trying to hide this. If I recall correctly, he posted it on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that crazy?
Absolutely. No, everybody, like everybody knew this. It wasn't a secret at all.
Yeah. I know. You did mention this issue of educating people. Right. People in quotes here, around air quotes. Now, that certainly was an odd word that stuck out in my mind, too. And I think the reason why Judge Castell chose the word people is because of the way in which the prosecution had framed their case. This was rather interesting because there was a stipulation that the government engaged in during the lead up to trial. And that stipulation was that what Virgil said at the conference did not give North Korea any additional capabilities than they already had.
Absolutely.
That's the government of North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very, very important stipulation, I think, to recall in the context of this case, because that means that Virgil didn't teach the country of North Korea anything at all. It was the government's theory that there were certain individuals, certain people in the audience that benefited from the things that he said at the conference, not the country itself, but certain people. And I think that's probably why Judge Castell chose the term people.
But couldn't those people have gotten that same information from other people in their country that already knew the answers?
Possibly. But, you know, for that, that's, I think, a distinction without a difference for our present purposes, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing that also stuck out in my mind here, too, was the procedure at the sentencing hearing itself. You know, there is no set prescription for how these things work, and different courts and different judges will do it in different ways. But the order here was that the government was able to speak first. They had the right to make their case with regard and contest the government's sentencing memorandum, the government's positions. At the conclusion of the government's – I'm sorry, at the conclusion of the defense's statement, that was when Judge Castell gave Virgil the opportunity to speak. And I will tell you this, Judge Castell listened and hung on to every single word that Virgil said. He listened more astutely to Virgil than anybody else in that courtroom. And he even had interrupted Virgil at the outset of his statement and asked him to clarify what exactly it was that he was saying in his first sentence, because he wanted to make sure he understood it. And then he even read back some of his words in his sentencing pronouncement. And I thought that, you know, that was a good thing. You want a judge to listen to the defendant. But the procedure here was defense first, then the defendant, Virgil, got to speak, and then the government got to go. And that means that the government really had the last word here. And the government at that point had the opportunity then to speak to the points that Virgil spoke about when he was talking to the judge. And in a lot of cases, as I understand it, in a lot of different courts, it's the defendant who usually gets the last word. But there's no set prescription on how these things work. But I think it's just a matter of course. It's the defendant's liberty at stake here. And I think it just makes more sense to have the defendant speak last. But that's, you know, that's frankly up to the judge. I will say this, too. It was brought up in the government's case that certain representatives of Virgil's had gone onto the radio and were trying to drum up support for his cause.
Okay, hang on. So obviously they're talking about us, and we're representatives of. See, this is what I mean. They distort, they make things up, and they paint a picture which is completely untrue. We're not representatives of anyone except ourselves, and we're speaking about a friend of ours. But to make it sound like he had us do his bidding, which is what I take from this statement, that's completely inaccurate.
Well, I don't think it's too inaccurate because Virgil was also my client, still is my client.
But did he tell you what to say on the radio?
No, he, of course, didn't give me direction of what to say on the radio.
He sure didn't tell me, because
representative of his on the radio. But
I haven't talked to him since 2019, so he didn't tell me what to say. And, you know, I've been pretty much the most outspoken one here as far as this particular case goes. So, you know, just painting that picture in a courtroom, I think, is very, very unfair and just not accurate.
Well, I just don't see how it's relevant. I mean, I don't take any offense to the characterization of me being represented. Well,
why did they bring it up?
I think that's accurate.
They brought it up to gain an advantage of some sort, right?
They brought it up to gain an advantage to show that, you know, Virgil had was trying to use the media to drum up support. You know, they had this notion in their sentencing memorandum that he was trying to use this case, you know, as a cause celeb to, you know, to promote himself as a form of self-promotion. They seem to bring it up in that type of context. You know, that, you know, there were podcasts, there were radios. You know, his representatives were out there, you know, banging the drum and trying to get supporters. I mean, we were on this radio station several times talking about this case. You had opined for, I recall, maybe 40 minutes after Virgil pleaded guilty on 27th of September 2021.
I'm sorry.
And we were asking for nothing other than people to reach out and write support letters for Virgil. That's what we were doing. Mm-hmm. We were asking people that had some contact with him, that knew him, to contact us and tell us in a support letter about how Virgil may have helped you, how he may have contributed to your charity, contributed to your education, done something helpful, because all of that helps the court form a better and richer picture.
Except it didn't. Except it didn't. He didn't pay attention to any of those letters. Not one of them made a bit of difference.
What I don't like is the fact that what we were doing was not ill-intentioned in any way. We were trying to generate a more full and rich picture of who Virgil is as a person so that he could be properly sentenced before the judge, so that justice could be served. And taking that kind of action, that kind of innocent activity, where we're out asking for support for somebody whose liberty is imminently to be taken away for a number of years, and whose liberty had been taken away since last summer, and we're out there speaking on his behalf, that should not be something that comes up in the context of a negative characteristic, something that for which he should be sent. You know, but frankly, it wasn't something that factored into.
No, I think it was, because look at what the
decision.
Look at what Judge Castillo said. He said that Virgil wants to be the center of attention. He wants to be some kind of a hero. And that factors in directly with him having his representatives basically paint him in a good light on the radio. It's nonsense. It's not accurate. It's false. Let's give some other people on the show a chance to weigh in. Kyle, I know you had something to say.
Well, oh gosh, there's a lot of different responses I had just listening to all of the coverage you were citing and your kind of reaction personally. I don't think that this has fixed things quite as much as the government might think it has. I don't think that you know, the speaking of sanctions in general, like the country of North Korea has been evading them for quite some time, and well before the advent of cryptocurrency. And I think this idea that future crimes that, and this is a sort of a core tenet of the criminal justice system or sham or whatever, you know, you want to think of it as in society, it is about sort of preventing other further crime, because these will be the consequences. And citing an ongoing war with a different adversary that preceded, you know, that was after this activity, this speaking at an event, that I think seems like he's paid the cost and is going to pay the price for these the mere possibility that sanctions or someone will transfer technology in the future. And I mean, this is someone who self-reported. This was not like a quid pro quo or like some kind of scheme of where he was being, you know, financed or for hire in some way. He was simply sharing ideas and stuff. So that kind of irks me. That bothers me a bit, because I know that stuff is going to continue to go on. And ultimately, I think it seems like the government, with the self-reporting stuff, didn't need him. Maybe already knew what they wanted, had other avenues to contain cryptocurrency. But I think the things that he was sharing, like having a server hosting there, you know, I'm not saying, you know, that they should have been, you know, planting ideas with him and immediately setting up some kind of sting or having him orchestrate something like on behalf of the government, on behalf of the U.S. or intelligence or private security or other agencies. I don't see that was his intent. He was just saying what he had observed and just so that he could be in, cleared for having traveled and done it. And I think he had researched a little bit beforehand, before he had traveled. Like, he was, from how I heard his story of traveling and making this talk, it seemed to me, my impression was that he had been on the up and up beforehand, mm-hmm. Afterward, and of course, when he was traveling, visiting on the East Coast, and then was intercepted, once they had a sort of a little bit different case than maybe he thought was going on.
Give you an example. He asked me to go. You know, I don't know anything about cryptocurrency. I'm not in any way an expert. And, you know, this wasn't about that. This was about seeing a crazy place like North Korea. I'd already been to North Korea. Didn't need to go back. I've seen it. I get how crazy it is, but I do recommend it to people. And the whole, Trump spur of the moment ban of Americans being allowed to go to North Korea, it wasn't seen as a serious thing. I don't think anyone has been prosecuted for that up until this. And, it didn't seem like the kind of thing that anybody was really going to take that seriously. And going to a conference as an excuse to go to North Korea, answering a few rudimentary questions, again, didn't seem like a big deal. I know I talked to him at the time, and the only thing I was worried about was that he might say something in North Korea that would get him in trouble over there. Never thought for a second that the people he had to worry about were the people in this country. That's a very sobering thing for me to realize.
Yeah, a lot of backward stuff, or counterintuitive things that just seemed just to be the way that wove a narrative other than the sort of honest and I don't know, just brave. I mean, it's brave to make that trip in the first place. And I don't think I would touch it with a 10-foot pole. I think that's a different decision for different people. I think the concerns about how you go about doing that kind of travel. But it's not unheard of for people to travel there. Even journalists,
of course,
but so much is going on there with, people who have visited and I don't think it would be, I don't think it was a wise decision. I mean, I don't have the kind of options and personally, it wouldn't have been my decision, but just saying that you're open to something like that shouldn't be a suspicious thing. And it just seemed like at every step, even being open and researching it, he was reframed to fit something that served other purposes.
That has been established. He made a mistake. It was bad judgment. How much do you make somebody suffer for that mistake? That is really what the question is. Robin Gila, floor is yours.
Yeah. So if the judge said that Virgil sent representatives, plural, to go talk him up on the radio, I mean, we've only got one Alex and nobody else was working in any way on this case. So, you know, that's already incorrect. But also, and I have not passed the bar, but I know a little bit. I do not speak for anyone but myself when I say this. I think this verdict is full of crap, and I think this a great wrong has been done. As we've discussed on this program time and again, he was over there not working for an enemy government to do all sorts of high-level crypto stuff. He was at an event for enthusiasts. you know, kicking around Wikipedia level knowledge of this stuff. They did not need Virgil Griffith for that information. People had that information. People had access to that information. And it was certainly nothing beyond where they already were on an organizational level, on a governmental level, with this technology. So what we are seeing, I believe, is something that we are all too familiar with in the hacker community, which is somebody gets set up by a prosecution, into just a big example of what happens when you do something naughty, when you go against the rules, when you hack. And I think we've been seeing this for generations now in the hacker world. We have seen people get sentenced ridiculous amounts of time for crimes which shouldn't perhaps have even been crimes in the first place. And this is affecting somebody who does not deserve this. And I'm looking into the facility he's in, MDC Brooklyn, and even just the visitation situation over there is extremely restrictive, even for a federal prison, as I understand it. And it does not paint a good picture of his future in this facility. I want to know from Alex, what do you feel being moved somewhere else from where he is?
And hopefully ensure facility for people pending trial. And it is a pretty terrible place, I will tell you. Said to me directly, but some of the stories are absolutely horrendous. And I've been there numerous times, and on one occasion they turned away a colleague of mine, even though he was on the cleared list. On another occasion, I showed up there, cleared the whole morning, whatever, and the place was on lockdown. And they said, nope, can't come in, on lockdown. And that just happens. I mean, it becomes very difficult sometimes to get in touch with your clients. And it's no secret now, but, Virgil had contracted coronavirus last year and was on a pretty severe rampant through the facility. Everybody was on lockdown for an extended period of time. And it was really horrendous conditions for him to endure. Facility, though, to answer your question, Rob, Judge Castell did agree to make the recommendation for Allenwood in Pennsylvania. That carries with it a great deal of weight, especially since Virgil has family connections over there. In all likelihood, within a month, and fingers crossed, he will be transferred there. Because it's Allenwood, my understanding in discussing with others who are more familiar with this type of situation than I am is that because it doesn't involve a flight, it doesn't involve transferring through other facilities, and it's just a few hours away and accessible through a bus or via a bus, Virgil could be on his way over to Allenwood in a short period of time, maybe within a week, maybe 2 weeks, but very certainly, hopefully within a month. And I think the sooner. And Allenwood, I think, would be a good place for him too, because this is a pretty bad sentence. It's a long sentence. It's 63 months. It's harsh. In federal prison, you generally will do about 85% of that time. Programs that you can take advantage of during your sentence that can help you reduce that sentence even further. So, if he takes advantage of all of those things that are available to him, hopefully at Allenwood, I think it's possible he might be able to get his sentence further reduced. And I think the sooner we get Virgil out of there, the sooner he can begin to contribute back to society. This is a person that Judge Castell himself acknowledged during sentencing has a great deal to give back to the world, a great deal of skills. And I think somebody who not only has contributed, in my opinion, a tremendous amount to others, to our community, but who also has tremendous potential. This is not going to be the defining moment of Virgil's life if he has any say about it.
Well said. And just to be clear, Virgil pled guilty, so the verdict was pretty much decided at that point. It's the sentencing that seems overly harsh. And as to what you just said, Alex, I wish the judge had a conversation, like a 20-minute, half-hour conversation with Virgil in his chambers. He would have gotten to know him. He would have gotten to understand a little better who it was he was dealing with. We know him. We know he's a unique individual. We know his quirks and things that you just cannot sum up on paper. But you can make someone look really, really bad. And that is what has happened here, and why there is so little sympathy for Virgil, because people read what is said in newspapers, on the Associated Press, and if they get particular facts wrong, like the story I read where they got basically the opening sentence wrong, that's how you're going to judge the person. And it's not fair. When somebody is accused of spying for North Korea, that's hard to come back from. And it doesn't matter that it isn't true. Gila, did you have anything?
I'm overtaken by sadness in this whole thing. Sadness about feeling hopeless in that what is there to say, what is there to do, the concept of the carceral system and this whole sense of making him an example in the hope of stopping people further from this sort of activity, whatever activity they've decided it was. I'm sad. I'm not even to angry yet. I'm just sad. And it's almost paralyzing sadness. And I've never even met Virgil. I'm just sad.
And you know what? The person who would comfort you in this situation is Virgil himself. He would be the one out there telling you it's going to get better. He has that amazing ability. You know, he sent me a Christmas present. He was in prison. And he somehow was able to send me this really complex mathematical thing. Kyle, I think you can describe it better. I couldn't understand it, of course, but to take the time, and I know I wasn't the only one, to take the time to actually think of somebody when you're going through this hell.
Yeah, he sent us a couple books and geode, or it's like a specific shape, a mathematical shape, and it doesn't stay upright. I don't know how else to describe
exactly.
it.
Exactly. These are the kinds of things that he values. And
it's a puzzle. It's kind of a spectacle.
And, you know, I couldn't even respond to him for fear of saying the wrong thing that might get him in more trouble. You know, I like to think at this stage, okay, it's done. I can finally, A, express myself, and B, hopefully talk to him and maybe see him in person. You know, it's the very least that I think I can do.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, let's keep our fingers crossed here that Virgil gets his assignment, goes over to Allenwood, gets out of the MDC, and begins, I think, a productive sentence over there. I have no doubt in my mind that he's going to be doing good things for other people, will be making the most of his time, and that, as I said before, I think he still has a great deal to give to this world and to give to our community, and I look forward to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I cannot believe, well, I guess I can believe we took the entire hour to talk about this. It's an important case. We're going to talk about other things on Overtime in a few minutes over on YouTube. Check the link on the top of 2600.com or just go to YouTube channel 2600. The channel is called channel 2600. We'll be on there at 8 o'clock. You can write to us, oth@2600.com. That's our email address. Give us your thoughts, opinions, whatever you feel like saying. And, of course, don't forget to support WBAI, because without this radio station, we couldn't even talk about this and reach people. Give a call to 212-209-2950. Pledge whatever you can afford and encourage other people to do the same. Or go and visit give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. And you can pledge for all kinds of interesting premiums on that website. But having a voice like this in the middle of the FM dial, in the middle of New York City, it matters. It really matters, just like so many things we talk about and try to appreciate. They matter as well. All right. We'll see you over on Overtime, or we'll see you next week at 7 p.m. Good night, everybody.
If you're filing taxes, you may be eligible for some pretty unique deductions. For instance, there are write-offs for clarinet lessons. Or if you hired your cat for pest control, apparently there's a tax break for that too. But if you don't think you'd qualify for pet-related deductions, you could just donate a vehicle to WBAI. It's easy, free, and tax-deductible. Here's how it works. Call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or complete the online form at wbai.org/donateyourcar. From there, our vehicle donation support team will take care of everything, including the pickup, sale, and provide you with a donation receipt. If your vehicle sells for more than $500, you'll also receive a 1098C tax form. So, instead of writing off your cat patrol, you can support programs like the Cat Radio Cafe by donating a car, truck, RV, or boat. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit wbai.org/donateyourcar to get started.
Last year marked a decade since 10 bodies were found along Ocean Parkway on Gilgo Beach in Suffolk County. Seven were later confirmed to be sex workers. Sex Work After Gilgo is a three-part investigative radio series that explores the relationship between sex workers and law enforcement. In the series, independent journalist Alexander Whitbeck looks at the unsolved Gilgo Beach murders by the Long Island serial killer to better understand how sex workers are policed on the island and in New York State. Tune into Sex Work After Gilgo, Friday afternoons at 5 p.m., beginning April 15th. Part 1 retells the history of the Gilgo murders, Part 2 looks at corruption in the Suffolk County Police Department, and Part 3 looks at the troubled relationship between sex workers and the police with sex worker rights advocates. That's Sex Work After Gilgo, Friday, April 15th, 22nd, and 29th at 5 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio and online at WBAI.com.
Joy of Resistance. We're sisters of the Joy of Resistance.
March is Women's History Month, dedicated to putting women back into histories written by men and about men. Every Thursday in March at 11 a.m., Joy of Resistance will bring you special women's history programming. We will cover the reproductive justice movement that brought a woman of color spin to reproductive rights, black women leaders of the civil rights movement, the FBI assault on the women's movement, the political history of the bra, and how book banning by the right wing is erasing women's history today. And that's only some of it. That's 11 a.m. on Thursdays in March. Women's history as you've never known it.
Joy of Resistance. Sisters of the Joy of Resistance. No corporation, government, religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy.
This is Cheryl Wills, and to be honest, usually I want you to tune in to see me on TV, Spectrum News New York 1, weeknights on Live at 10, but not this Friday.